Hello, ladies and gentlemen, welcome once again to another episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and I'm joined, as always, by my two cohorts, Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hey.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hey.
This is okay. I'm convinced that you two have, like, decided, outside of our normal conversations, that you're just going to say the same thing every week.
I mean, it works every time. It's just perfect.
Yeah, it's not very hard to synchronize.
It's weird, especially when I make you go one right after the other. I'm going to make you say something at the exact same moment next week, just to see if I can circumvent that. But that's beyond the point. For anyone just joining us for the first time, the Film Stage Show is a movie podcast where we talk about recent releases in film. We'll have our primary review today be The Master, the new film by Paul Thomas Anderson. And we'll also have Danny tell us a little bit about Trouble with the Curve. Not a full review, but a basic encapsulation of his thoughts on the film. Before we get into that, we will be giving our movie discussion topic a glancing over. Today we'll be talking about auteurs and the people who love them, and how we let that affect our judgments and views of their films. And then we'll wrap up at the end of our podcast with our recommendations for the week ahead. And if you ever have any need to speak with us, you can always email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com, and you can also, of course, subscribe to us on iTunes, give us a rating, star rating, comment, upvote other people who've commented that you agree with, anything at all, really. Let's get into our discussion topic for today, which, as I said, is a focus on auteurs, directors who, I guess, have created sort of a brand for themselves. Who here is good at explaining auteur theory? Because I always stumble over it.
If I may.
Yes, please.
Well, basically, the auteur theory, among many other things, it's kind of a long discussion topic, but we don't really have time for that, states that as a filmmaker, someone is the author of a film. They have their stamp on it, and it's their movie. If you work with an editor or a cinematographer or even an actor or screenwriter, even though they're putting in their own work, you are the one who is guiding it and dictating it, and you are responsible for how it comes out. That's one aspect of it. And another is that you can look at a film that the person has made without knowing that they directed it, or rather without being told that they directed it, and figuring out almost immediately that's their film. You could watch a film by Paul Thomas Anderson and you say, oh, well, that's PTA. You could watch a film by Godard and say, that's Godard. It's actually a pretty simple system. It's just that a lot of people don't understand it, unfortunately.
Yes, I always make the mistake of just trying to get too deep into it, but that was perfect. It was a great encapsulation of the idea. So we wanted to talk about not only a couple of our favorite auteurs, but also how we let that idea behind the authorship of a film inform the way that we look at their films. Are we perhaps a little kinder, a little more biased towards them? It's not the best word I could use, but that's what I'm sticking with. Does it in any way affect the way that we view their film in that we will give it a little more slack or try to read into it a little more than with other people? So, since Nick did such a good job of explaining that to us, why don't you start us off?
I thought you were going to say, because Nick did such a good job, why don't we hand it off to Danny?
Nick's already proved himself. It's Danny's turn. But no, Nick, really, go ahead.
Well,
we're sticking with you, man.
Yes, I am a big proponent of the auteur theory. I have some controversial opinions regarding that. For one thing, I've often said that when it comes to a respective film, even something like The Master, I don't care, for instance, who the cinematographer of the film is. Do not care at all.
Wow.
Because the way I see it is, if you're talking about a great director, and that's a film, if a film is made by a great director, that's the one you should be looking forward to. If that is in fact the case, the issue of the other people working on it shouldn't be such a big deal. Because if they are in fact an auteur, it's going to be their film. And I think because of that, the auteur theory is something that absolutely must be taken into account when you're discussing films. And it's not every film, of course. You're not going to talk about Taken 2 and go, ah, Olivia Megaton's best work yet. I mean, you could, but you're not going to. But if you're talking about this... this title is going to come up a lot, The Master, you're going to discuss it in the context of Paul Thomas Anderson's career, or at least I think you absolutely should. Because if you're not using context, then what's the point of even knowing the films that come before it?
I got to say that that is pretty damn controversial, because I definitely, I mean, me and cinematographers, we're pretty tight. I enjoy their work. I always look to see who's lensing a film, because I don't know, maybe I'm just weird. Danny, do you subscribe to the same ideas that Nick has just espoused?
Well, I wouldn't say that I, you know, if I, when I heard that Paul Thomas Anderson is going to be working with a new cinematographer for The Master, I definitely didn't like just take that news and like forget about it. Like it was nothing. Like it was definitely in my back of the head, in the back of my head, both before I saw the film and while I was watching it. But, you know, there's a sense where all of Anderson's previous films have been beautifully shot, and this one is incredibly shot. So you can definitely make the argument that Nick's making, which is that the reason for that is Anderson and not the cinematographer. But you know, the less controversial aspect of what Nick talked about, which is important to the auteur theory as well, is the idea of context and longevity, which is that you look at a film in context of a director's career. Anderson especially is really fun to do with that, because there's such a thematic consistency to his work. It kind of makes you think about some other directors, like maybe Soderbergh, who's kind of more over the map. And, you know, Soderbergh's obviously an auteur, but kind of analyzing his work from film to film is a lot more of a kind of weird and difficult task. It's tough to pin down. And that also just speaks to the kind of lack of concreteness in the theory. You know, it's tough to be as black and white with each example.
Insofar as I subscribe to the auteur theory, I view it more thematic, a little less stylistic. Even though, obviously, I mean, Malick is an auteur, and there's the running joke that he just shoots trees and people, you know, running their hands over waves of grain. And I mean, that's true, and that is something where you look at it and you're like, well, I'm watching a Malick film, so that fits. But, you know, I prefer the deeper ideas and thoughts that are coming out of a film rather than things like that. So I guess that's one of the reasons why I can subscribe to it, but still find everyone's work in the film to be equally as important as the director's, just in a pure style level. Cinematographers, production designers, I mean, I don't know, I'm weird. I mean, Jack Fisk is a production designer on The Master, and he recently did Tree of Life. And it was weird for me, because in watching the film, I was like, I wonder if it was the same guy. And so then when the movie was over, I looked it up, and it actually was. And he's fantastic. And I don't know, I feel like a director, an auteur, who does have control over stuff like that, they employ people as a means of delegating their responsibilities. And so, you know, it's still technically their authorial vision, but they're still implementing people that they know will coincide with it. So it's like a really good collaboration rather than just a complete solo work.
But it's a coinciding.
Yes.
Yes. So, okay, you want to talk about Malick. Look at The Thin Red Line and then look at The New World.
Yes.
Quote unquote shot by two different cinematographers, but visually they don't look that different. They're pretty similar. I mean, the color hue is a little different, but in terms of the way they're filmed, they look very identical. I mean, you could take screenshots from one film of a character walking through a field of tall grass. You could take another shot from the other film of a character walking through a field of tall grass, and what would you get, right?
Yes.
Exactly. See, I sort of – I'm starting to I'm coming to resent when people get excited over the cinematographer of a film.
Really?
Because I'm someone who is particularly indebted to the director. They're the one who I think of when I watch a film.
And I mean, they're obviously the person I think of the most, but I don't think it's fair to just discredit the work of everyone else.
I'm not discrediting their work. I'm just saying that a lot of that is owed to the director. Well, not in every case, but if we're talking about, again, auteurs, a lot of that is owed to the director who is dictating what is going to be done.
Right.
So I feel as though, I don't care who the cinematographer of a film is at all. I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay. That's cool. I'm not a cinematographer. I don't know any cinematographers, so I'm not going to take offense. I mean, you know, I constantly say this because, you know, these discussions aren't here to pick a winning point of view. It's just to, you know, espouse points of view and let people know where we stand and to have a good discussion. So it's perfectly fine that we disagree, even though I'm right. No, I understand what you're saying, and I can see it, but I don't subscribe to it, if that makes sense. But I get it. I get it. You make a compelling point, but I don't know. Maybe it's my background in photography. I mean, I think it's important. And I get that they're playing to the vision of the director and that the director is the overseer. But I'm trying to think of a good analogy. Like, an architect will design a building and will design it down to the fixtures, but they don't go in and make the fixtures. Like, someone has to help that vision become a reality. And it's vaguely unfair to discredit the work of the stonemasons or the tap makers. I don't know what you call someone who makes like sinks, but you know, it's vaguely unfair to just discredit their work.
But again, I'm not discrediting their work. I'm just owing a lot of it to the director.
No, I gotcha. I understand.
I'll say this. Look at Steven Spielberg's recent films where he's worked with Janusz Kaminski, right? He's working with him because he wants the look that he's going to provide. I feel like that encapsulates it pretty well. But it's not as though Kaminski is coming in and then he's going to completely change the look of the film on his own accord.
Right.
It's all under Spielberg's guise, you see?
I feel like we're saying the same thing, but I don't even know. I feel like we're just saying the same thing, but perhaps, like the blind man feeling the elephant, we have different opinions on it.
Maybe.
Because I know what you're saying, and that's basically what I'm saying, but I think that like those people have honed their craft and created their own brand, I guess you could say, so that people will come and seek them out because of that.
Right. Here's another way of putting it. I think someone like an actor is more flexible in their filmic work than a cinematographer, because I think an actor is often called upon to, I mean, yes, there are some people who, such as, I don't know, Jack Nicholson nowadays or Christopher Walken, who are called upon to deliver a certain kind of performance.
Right.
But you look at Joaquin Phoenix in The Master, and he's playing this complete psychopath, or Philip Seymour Hoffman, who is maybe the most flexible actor of our generation. Right.
I get behind that. Yeah.
Think about Philip Seymour Hoffman in this film, and then think about him in Boogie Nights. Could they be any more different? Honestly.
Oh, I thought you were just saying that metaphorically. I agree. Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, yeah. This discussion has gone in a direction I did not foresee it. Let's wrap up by just touching on this idea. Do we give a little more slack to auteurs that we follow and respect? This idea that, like, you know their work and you have the context, so you look perhaps a little harder for something behind it than you usually would? Like, do you go out of your way to try to find the meaning that you're sure they put in there, even if it's not overtly apparent at first?
For the most part, yes, but there have been instances where I'll watch a film by an auteur and there's clearly nothing there, and I'm just not going to work to find it.
Okay. Yeah, I view it as sort of like panning for gold. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's there, and if it's there, you'll find it. You know, you're not going to... I'm very paranoid about this idea that people are going to believe that I'm just reading into something to try to appear intelligent. And maybe that's just because I was ridiculed for that throughout high school and college. I'm not going to instill into a work a theme or an idea that I don't think was present. I mean, if it's not immediately apparent and I search for it and find it, then that's great. But I mean, especially for auteurs, you know, you have this idea like, I know this guy, as odd as it is to say that. Like, I know where he's coming from. So you know where to look, you know where to find the ideas. And if I can't find them there, then yeah. I'm trying to think if there's a recent example of someone who I was just like, you know, you and me are close, man, but you really dropped the ball this time. But I don't think I've had that issue lately. Mm. Danny, what about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of this still comes down to your personal feelings about a director. Like, I know kind of earlier this year with like Wes Anderson and Moonrise Kingdom, I wasn't like crazy about that movie. I really liked it, but I wasn't tempted to give it any leeway, even though he's obviously an auteur and he has his own brand of filmmaking. But like when I see something like The Master, that just jumps off the screen to me as something that's more filled with like hidden gold, like you said. So I think as much as tempting as it is to kind of pin like critics and film writers into this group where they try to search for things that aren't there just because they love a certain director. It still kind of comes down to like your individual reaction to a film as well.
Yeah, actually,
I think that should. Oh,
go ahead.
Okay, I think that should. I think that's absolutely correct. Although I would also say that when we talk about panning for gold, I don't know if we would include this in, or I don't know if you two would include this in it, but I certainly would. The idea that when you're looking at a film from an esteemed director, you're also thinking about, how would I put this? Not necessarily how far they've come, but how it stands out from the rest of their work. I think a very good semi-recent example of this would be Haywire, which maybe is not an outstanding film, but I think part of the reason I enjoyed it so much is knowing that Steven Soderbergh was behind it and the fact that he could direct an action scene so well and make a fun spy thriller, which he had never really done before.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Part of my joy from that film was that idea, because I didn't dig Contagion that much. That was one of those films where it really was just kind of like, this is here, and I don't really get the point, and it's kind of boring. But seeing him apply that skill and that craft to Haywire was, like, exhilarating. On top of it, you know, just being a damn good movie. Wes Anderson, actually, Moonrise Kingdom, I mean, I can see how people would look at that and just be like, it's another quirky Wes Anderson film. But because I was able to contextualize it along with the themes of all of his other films, I think I was able to get a lot more out of it than most people I know who saw it. So, yeah. Any final thoughts on this discussion before we head off into the movie that we've been kind of dancing around, The Master?
Don't be afraid to dive deep into a director's career. I don't know if that's a real thought.
I was trying to think of a joke about, like, Narcosis or the Bends, but I failed. All right. Well, anyway, let us now segue into our discussion of a film by a modern auteur, Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, which is starring Amy Adams, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Joaquin Phoenix.
Why all the stalking and sneaking? You've wandered from the proper path, haven't you? The problems you have.
I don't have any problems. I don't know what I told you, but if you have work for me to do, I can do it.
Familiar to me.
All right, that was a clip from the trailer of The Master, which is out in a limited release. It's kind of gone wide. It should be in most major markets by now. I know it came to DC this last week. It opened the week before in New York and LA. And this is a movie with a deceptive sort of synopsis behind it. Joaquin Phoenix plays Freddie Quell, a disturbed war veteran from World War II, who in the 1950s falls in with a Scientology-esque cult, which is led by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Who Don't say there. The S word.
It's the only time I'll say it. Swear to God. I'll even bleep it out. That's a lie. I don't know how to do that. Yeah, this movie. Quite a bit to talk about. So why don't we kick it to Danny to start us off?
All right. So I've seen The Master twice, and I've had very distinct reactions to each viewing. My first one was an early screening in Chicago that was, I don't remember exactly, maybe 3 or 4 weeks before the theatrical release. And obviously the experience of seeing something like that without truly having like read anything about it was a little bit daunting. Couple that with the fact that it probably is Anderson's most maybe narratively ambiguous film. It was kind of a challenging viewing, even though I knew from the first frame that it was something worth admiring. My second viewing I saw on opening night, and the whole thing struck me as deceptively simple in the sense that I just kind of followed everything and it seemed a lot more logical and less opaque than it did the first time. So I feel like I need a third viewing to kind of come to a consensus as to what my overall thoughts are. But the things I know for sure are that maybe the first hour of this movie is some of the best filmmaking of Anderson's career, if not the complete best. The two performances are just from Hoffman and Phoenix, and Adams absolutely are in their own league. And the whole thing just feels to me like it's on a completely different level than so many than almost everything else I've seen recently. It's just from the first frame, it has this confidence and assurance that you just don't really find in American movies that often. Most of my reservations about the film, which still kind of hold up after a second viewing, are narratives, so I'll hold those back until spoiler section. But definitely a big recommendation for me, and like, yeah, one of my favorite films of the year so far.
All right, and Nick, what is your view?
I think I'm sort of in the same boat as Danny. I've seen this movie once, so also saw it on opening night. I plan to see it next week, so I don't know. Can I come back next week and just review it then? Or?
It's funny that you say that, because there was a part of me that was like, I've only seen it once. I saw it opening night here in D.C. And immediately upon leaving, I was like, holy shit, I need to see that again before we podcast, because I have no idea what I'm going to say.
Right. Anyway.
It is that kind of movie.
Going off that, I feel as though every sentence should start with, I'm pretty sure, when I'm reviewing this film. So I'm pretty sure it's great. And I sort of have a very specific idea as to what the film's thesis is. I don't know if I'll share it just because I started to write something about the movie and didn't finish it, but maybe I'll finish it after I see it again. But yeah, I do think that the film has a very specific through line. And the way it gets there is, if not exactly enigmatic, because I don't think this is necessarily it's a narratively or structurally complex film. It's like what Danny said, it's deceptively simple. But the manner in which it gets there is very interesting, because it's thrilling, it's frustrating, it's beautiful all the way through. That's probably the one element that's entirely consistent, is how beautiful this film is. See it in 70mm. And so I feel as though Anderson's main point here is not necessarily to offer a screed against religion or things like alcoholism or anything like that. I think that what he's trying to portray here is basically a tragedy. And in that sense, he succeeds completely. Because I think this is, without question, the saddest film of his entire career. I mean, uncontested. Even more so than Boogie Nights, which I think is saying something. So, yes, those are sort of thoughts, I guess.
Those are the half-form ideas that are left in our minds after having seen this film an insufficient number of times. I want to get into the sadness when we go into spoilers, so let's put a pin in that. Before that, though, I guess I should give my opinion on this film. I'll give my opinions in the order they came to me while watching this film. First, there was, holy shit, this is beautiful. The opening shot, 70mm, just like clear blue water churning and the sunlight glinting off of it. And at that moment, it's such a simple shot, but it's so freaking gorgeous that you just kind of know that you're in the middle of something special.
Don't you kind of just wish, because whenever he goes back to the shots, don't you wish he'd just stay on that for a few minutes?
Yeah.
The turbines of the boat churning.
Yes.
Moment
of silence for this film. Just odd appreciation. Next was, I'm like, I need to see this movie again, because I need to get beyond how good Joaquin Phoenix is. Does that make sense? Like, every moment that he was on screen, I was transfixed to the point of, like, awe by his performance, that it was difficult for me to pay attention to the film itself.
Like, it's almost scary what he does at times.
Yeah.
Just how committed he is. It's like there's, like, we know what method acting is, but this is one of the few times where you can, like, and with Hoffman too, I think in parts of the movie, like, you can see the actor is as lost as the character, and they're just out of control, and it's so exciting.
Yeah, it's thrilling. But like I said, and it's not one of those things where it's like a showy performance, so it detracts from what's happening. It's just like, it's so transfixing that you sort of forget that there's a movie playing and you should probably be paying attention to the narrative. So that was great. The music was also incredible. There's this, I don't know how they do it. It's in one of the trailers, perhaps the trailer that I'll put up. It sounds like just like taking a stringed instrument and hitting the strings with the back of the bow.
Almost. Yeah, that track is called Aletheia on the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Yeah, I'm totally going to have to buy the soundtrack. And yeah, just from there, it all spirals outward. Like, the acting from everyone is really good. Surprisingly enough, because one of the actors, he plays the husband of one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's character's daughters. I've only ever seen him in two other things, and they were both really awful comedies. And so it was vaguely unsettling at first to see him. But he won me over. He was very good. I don't know what the actor's name is. Perhaps I'll find out at some
point. Rami Malek.
There we go. Yeah, he was fantastic. I don't know. I don't know why he's been in such shit before this. But I'm looking forward to seeing him more in other stuff, because he's only in like three scenes. But very good, very good. Yeah, I don't know. It's really difficult for me to parse out into words what I loved so much about this film. Even using the word love seems like a half-formed, like, I don't even know if it's love. It's really good, and I need to see it again, and I feel like that's its own kind of compliment right there. My own thoughts on the thesis of the film, I don't know that it's particularly anti-religion. I heard a lot of people say that, and the weird thing is that it doesn't, to me at least, it doesn't seem like it's passing any intense judgment on the members of the cause, which is the name
no,
of
it's not.
Cultish religion that this thing is. Yeah, and I mean, it. There's a point, we'll get into this more in spoilers, where I basically figured that the entire thesis of this film is in the name of the movie. It's the master, and it's looking at what we allow to lead our lives. And in some cases, it's our impulses, it's our human nature, it's the animalistic side of us. And then in other cases, it's the part of us that's moving towards something more civilized, which could be religion, it could be, you know, science, it could be anything. And it's so difficult to talk about this only having seen it once. So that's my half-formed idea. It'll be easier to kind of flesh that out in spoilers.
Tell you what, let's stop now. See it again. Come back next week. And we'll have it ready.
It'll be a two-part podcast. Let's just spend every weekend for the rest of the year. We'll see the film, and then we'll come back and discuss what new opinions and ideas we have on it.
I don't really have a problem with that.
I don't have a problem with it either. Let's just make a spin-off podcast, The Mastercast.
It would sort of be better if the line, "just say something that's true," was actually in the film, because it'd be like, very fitting.
Yeah.
For this.
I would have been a little too on the nose. That is something that we can point out in spoilers, or without going into spoilers. A lot of the stuff that was in the promotional material for this was not in the actual film. And yeah. How did you all feel about that? Because, like, in certain cases, like the line "just say something true," I felt that it was as powerful as that seemed in the trailer, just free of all context. Given where it would have gone in, I feel like that would have been a little too on the nose. Like, it's a perfect trailer moment. Yeah. I don't know about the film.
I guess I'm maybe in agreement on that. In terms of the other stuff that was cut, I do miss some of the shots, such as the two people jumping off of the boat, which is really beautiful, and I bet it would have looked nice in 70mm, but what the hell, it's not there. In particular, I actually prefer, there's a scene in the film where Freddie Quell, the protagonist, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is given a Rorschach test. And it's very funny in the movie, but the clip that went online a week before the film came out is a completely different scene. And I actually think it's a much better scene. So that's an example of something I would have liked to have seen kept in. Otherwise, none of it is that huge. I don't know if a shot of Amy Adams firing a gun is essential to the film, for instance.
Yeah, I didn't feel the lack of that scene. Danny, what about you?
Well, I think that he was probably sitting on a lot of footage that was amazing that he knew wasn't going to be in the film. Or not that he knew wasn't going to be in the film, but when he was editing, that he knew wasn't going to work. So I kind of just accepted that when I realized some of those really good shots weren't going to be in the film. But I think as a marketing strategy that it's really brilliant, because even though the trailer has a lot of stuff that's in the film, you make certain clips and like teasers. Like the first teaser is literally incapable of spoiling anything because it's not in the movie. So yeah. I think that's kind of like really amazing as a marketing strategy. Yeah.
It also kind of creates the sensation that you're getting more when you see the film, because it feels, I sort of suspect that Anderson knew the people who were truly excited for this movie were going to watch every bit that came out from it. And like I did, for instance. And then when you actually see the movie, there's almost a greater sense of discovery there, because this is something that you haven't seen before, even though you think you have, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does. See, I'm a little different. I specifically stayed away from some stuff because I didn't want to see too much of the film. So now I feel like I have to go back and look at some of this other stuff, like you were talking about the Rorschach scene, because it's not in there. So it won't hurt me to see it. Plus, I've already seen the whole film now. I feel like now is probably a good time to get into spoilers. Does everyone agree with me?
I guess so.
Right? I mean, like, does anyone have any final...
Yeah, I don't know how much you can spoil this film, to be honest.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, for people who want to stay away from major plot points or details.
Sure, but no, you're right. I'm just saying this isn't really a spoilerific film.
Yeah, it's not like a twist. You know, he's not really dead at the end or something. But yeah, let's get into spoilers. So anyone...
Can you believe the scene where Joaquin Phoenix stabbed Philip Seymour Hoffman with a fork?
Oh, man. Walking out of the theater... Because I had tried to keep so far from the film before just figuring it out, it was like one screening right after the other, and of course it was packed. So I'm walking to the theater, and for like two blocks from the parking lot to the theater, I'm walking by people who are holding the newsletter that this theater puts out, AFI Silver, and I could hear them talking, and they were talking about the movie. And so I started to like hum to myself and give them a wide berth to try to stay the hell away from them, because every single one of them was like just effusive and talking about it. And it reminded me about the scene in The Simpsons where it's a flashback to Homer and Marge going to see The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
And Homer walking by the line of people waiting to go in and see the film on opening night and saying, "Wow, what a good film. I can't believe that Darth Vader's Luke Skywalker's dad." Ah, man. All right. Completely inconsequential personal anecdote. Let's get into spoilers for The Master. Yeah. Nick, you'd said that you thought that this was the saddest film of Paul Thomas Anderson's career.
It is. And he's made some
downers.
Actually, I think he's only really made one downer, and that's Boogie Nights. The rest of his movies have a lot of unfortunate circumstances, but they end in a manner that I think is happy. Even There Will Be Blood.
I was about to say.
No, I think that's a happy ending, honestly.
Okay. I guess we shouldn't spoil the most traditional. No.
Oh, come on.
Okay, spoilers for There Will Be Blood. Everyone, pause for 12 seconds.
No, don't even say that. Don't even say that. If somebody's listening to this and they haven't seen There Will Be Blood.
Well, now they've had enough time to turn us off if they haven't. So you believe that bludgeoning someone to death with a bowling pin is a happy ending?
I think it's a triumphant ending for Daniel Day-Lewis, yeah.
But he's not the type of guy you want to see triumph.
I want to see him triumph over Eli Sunday. You don't?
I guess I do. I was happy to see his son walk out. Like, that was my triumph. Everything after that was just gravy. When he just walks out and starts his own business, I was like, thank God, get away from that guy. But yeah. So anyway, can you expound upon the reasons for your sadness?
The last shot. What else needs to be said? Other than the last shot of this movie, is fucking crushing. I saw the movie a week ago, and I'm still thinking about it, and it still bums me out to think about that shot of him lying on the sand with that nude figure made out of sand, as he's just lying there with that look of defeat on his face. And what makes it even sadder is to know that that's a flashback to when he was in the war, because what Anderson is saying there, quite simply, is that Freddy has completely regressed, and it's like there's been no progress on his own part, and he'll probably never be a functioning human ever again.
Right. He is always there on that beach.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think you think about Magnolia, depressing as shit for most of its runtime, and then it has a happy ending. Same thing with Punch Drunk Love and even, I guess, There Will Be Blood, although clearly there's a difference there.
Yes. I wanted to ask, I mean, this is a point, like, we all agree the movie's amazing. There's not really, like, a big twist to hang the hat on. So I just want to like bring up certain aspects of the film and get your opinions on them. What do you think was happening in the scene where he is having sex with the English woman and he's asking her all of the processing questions? Like, what did you think of that scene? Because I'm still wrapped up in that scene. Like, that's I think for me the thing that's sticking out most in my mind.
Does Danny want to go? Please.
Yeah, sure. yeah, that's an interesting scene. I've heard some people interpret it as the fact that he's like laughing while he's interrogating her is a sign that maybe he's moved on from the cause and he knows that it's kind of a meaningless made up thing that he can just put behind him. But I also think, you know, when you combine that with the final shot, there's a sadder edge to it where, yeah, maybe he's laughing, but he's still like asking her these weird questions that are probably confusing the hell out of her and making that encounter incredibly awkward. I mean, I just picture him like in later scenes going on with his life. And, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman is just stuck in his head and he doesn't really know what to do about it. And he's kind of, you know, like Nick said, he's kind of regressed and maybe even made worse by some of his memories because he had a friendship and he kind of lost it.
Yeah, that's how I was almost viewing it, because those questions are kind of the moment where he breaks down and Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is able to reach him and he has like that cathartic moment where like finally he's open and honest with someone and he understands someone and he now has finally a friend and someone who he feels like he can talk to. And here he is regressed back to, you know, his drinking, sexing ways of the previous life before he came to the cause. And yet he's still trying to, I can't figure out if he's trying to make himself care less about what he's just left behind by kind of degrading it this way, or if he's possibly trying to pantomime the situation that led to his breakthrough in the first place. And that uncertainty in that scene combined with the final shot is really, really quite crushing.
I don't think it's either, though. I would have to disagree.
What would you say?
I think in that scene he has... I think these lessons and these methods of teaching have been parlayed to him. And I don't think he's mocking it necessarily. I think he's legitimately trying to make it work. And he wants to be the master of someone else. And he just can't do it.
Right.
And that's part of his, again, to use that word again, sorry if it's getting belabored, but it's part of his regression. When he gets to that point, it's almost this lethal combination of what he was before and what he's been turned into now, which is actually worse than what we saw in the beginning, which is saying something because he was masturbating into the ocean. So.
Oh, man, I'd completely forgotten about that. Thank you for putting that image back in my head.
Great shot. You know what? You know, it's funny. If you buy the soundtrack on the song Able-Bodied Seaman, there's a they put in the dialogue where he's talking about getting rid of crabs.
You got to shave one testicle, yeah, so they all run to the other one. Then you got to light your hair on fire.
It's like an ice bucket. Stab every single fucking one of them. Good. And, yeah, just put that in there in the show somewhere.
All right. Man. I don't know. I don't need, like, this... It's a bad sign when your job is to talk about movies and a movie, like, I think, like, wrestles you into a state of, like, intellectual... atrophy. That's not a right word. I can't even think of the right word. The movie is so huge and enveloping that it's so difficult to find a point of entry to start talking about it. And there are so many moments and scenes that just beg to have whole books written about them. Mm. When he gets out of jail after attempting to defend Dodd, Hoffman's character, when he's being arrested, and they put him through that rigorous course that just goes on and on and on. Like, that scene felt in a good way. I don't want to make it seem like it was boring and it seemed to go on forever, but that scene felt like a fucking movie inside of this movie.
That's actually I guess this word will come up, sorry, but that actually is very much based on Scientology practices for when they want to indoctrinate members. They have them go through tests like that, which are very repetitive and almost degrading and are sort of nonsensical. I heard a story this person once told about, they claim that Tom Cruise made them for hours pick up an ashtray and move it somewhere and say, thank you for moving.
That is crazy.
You hear stories like this, though, that they make them do these sorts of tests. And that's an instance where, yeah, I guess maybe the comparisons to Scientology come up. But at the same time, I really resent when people call this, oh, that's the Scientology movie.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, okay, he looks like L. Ron Hubbard, and he says some similar things, and there are similarities in the tests that they're conducting, sure. But don't you think it's unfortunate how the movie has been saddled with this label?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it very obviously kind of is riffing on that. But at the same time, it's not doing it just to be, like, timely or controversial. Like, I feel like it fits so heavily with the theme of the film. Like, this... Because I'm Catholic. Even we don't... Like, the Pope, I guess, is our corporeal encapsulation of the church and the will of God. We don't view him with quite as much ardor as Scientologists view L. Ron Hubbard.
Hey, I was raised a Catholic. You don't have to hide it from me, man.
Yeah, I was about to say, this is the podcast where I finally just come out and say that I'm Catholic. I don't have to live in shame anymore. But no, I mean, you read interviews with people and they talk about him with such reverence. And it's just, that's the perfect way to get across this idea of a person who is able to create around himself this community of people who are just indebted to him. And it's interesting to watch as he attempts to supplant every other aspect of their lives and become their master, and watching him fail so readily with Freddy Quells, because he won't be controlled that way, and he has other masters to serve, I guess is the way to put it. I mean, it's like what he... You're watching Philip Seymour Hoffman, who so readily and easily controls other people, sometimes just by being the loudest person in the room. Like a...
Pig fuck!
Yeah, pig fuck! He can't stand up to a lot of criticism, and so the way that he gets around that is by not allowing it. And Freddy never really gives him any criticism. Like, there's no point where he says to him, I think you're full of horseshit. Like, he's perfectly willing to be whatever this guy wants him to be, except wherein he wants to supplant, you know, the drinking and the women and his just depression and mania. He would prefer to serve those than to serve Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, it's...
That sounds right.
All right. I'm glad, because when I first walked out of the film, I'm like, this is what I think. Now I'm pretty sure I might be wrong, though. But yeah, the more I've thought about it, the more I've kind of fallen into that, and I need to see it again just to see how well everything else syncs up. But I mean, like, it's a powerful idea. And that's why I say it's not really an anti-religion film, because it's saying, you know, there's the line, you know, if you can go out and learn how to live without a master, you'll be the first, I think. Yeah. I may be misquoting, but it's the general idea is there.
When I walked out of this movie, Danny can attest to this, I sort of didn't say anything. I was just kind of walking, and I had my index finger up to my lips. Can you picture that? Just me pondering. Because a lot of specific scenes were sticking out in my mind. One is the... But I'll get to that in a second. A lot of these scenes were sticking out in my mind, and I was trying to sort of piece it together, not narratively or structurally, again, because I don't think that's that complex, but thematically, there was a lot to sort through. And one portion that is still in my head is the department store scene, of which I'm sure you know I speak.
Yes.
It's that tracking shot where the woman is showing off her coat and going through, and I almost... See, this is part of why I have to say it again, because I feel like that scene, if I were to view the master once more, would make the entire thing click. I'm just not sure in what sense. It's almost as though I have a puzzle and there's like this one piece left. The problem is that you can turn it 8 different ways to make it fit. I just don't know which way to turn it, basically. Do we have any thoughts on that scene or anything about what it might mean or how it fits into the context of the film?
Danny?
Well... It's an interesting shot to try and contextualize because it literally just kind of comes out of nowhere in terms of like the way the shot's set up, where it's kind of following her through the store, almost like it's a dream or like you're gazing at her. It's tempting to maybe think of it as Freddy just kind of fantasizing over her, but there's no point of view shot. There's no shot of him to set it up as a point of view shot. So that's not entirely satisfying. And so you're left with this incredibly extravagant shot of a woman showing off a coat, and you have no idea why it's there, really.
Yeah. But I think I didn't have any idea why it was there as the scene was unfolding, but then...
Yeah, but then you...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it shows off that production design. Jack Fisk.
Jack Fisk.
We can drop his name again.
Way to go, Jack. No, I know what you mean. I mean, the shot is constructed and executed in such a way that there is something there. And it, again, you could read into it any number of things. Like, there's this woman just gliding through, showing off her coat, you know, just saying how much it is to all these different people. And then she shows up at his photo corner, I guess. It's, you know, not a kiosk or a booth or anything. But, I mean, it's so constructed in a way to draw attention to it that there must be something there. But
right.
I'm not 100% certain on what. And that's why I need to see it again.
I have some idea, but I'm not... I feel like maybe my interpretation of it is complete horseshit. So I'm a little scared of saying what I think the scene means in for the rest of the film.
Well, I think that scene, and this might just be me, it syncs up in my head thematically, maybe, with the scene when they're at the house in, I think it's Philadelphia, and Dodd is leading a rousing chorus, and he's dancing around, and suddenly none of the women are wearing clothes.
Yeah.
And that's obviously, you know, an insight into Freddy's mind and what he's thinking and seeing, and I feel as though, you know, that's just this... It's another point in favor of my theory about the film. You know, this guy, this incredibly charismatic guy, is controlling this room. And yet, Freddy, even while focusing on him, his baser instincts and that driving force is still there, secretly disrobing everyone.
And don't you think it's... Don't you think it's interesting how Amy Adams is the only woman in that scene who you don't see nude?
You mean find that full frontal?
You see her, you know, fake pregnant stomach, but right. You don't see anything else. And I found that particularly interesting.
Yes.
Especially how they're the only ones who are making eye contact, almost as though there's an understanding between the two. And I feel like, this is what I said to Danny after we saw it, that it almost feels like Freddy doesn't have any legitimate respect for women, but there's something about Peggy, that character, who sort of scares him and almost forces him into a sense of respect, and he doesn't just see her as something to put his penis in. So, see, there's so much to parse out here.
Right. We've been talking for almost an hour, so we actually do probably have to wrap up. I did want to ask, what were your thoughts on the relationship he had with Doris, the girl back home? Was that relationship and the way that it ended enough for you? Because I find myself wanting to know so much more about that.
I think it's... I think that... it's sort of what we see before when before he goes off to war, that's kind of laying the foundation for his own descent in a certain sense, because you can tell that's just the relationship which should not work out because she's 16 and he's Joaquin Phoenix. And... and then you jump ahead after the war and after the cause and all that, and she has gone away and she's become Doris Day. Her name is Doris Day. She's not actually the actress Doris Day.
Correct.
But anyway, I do find it, perhaps that's, okay, I'll put it this way. That's the foundation for his descent, their initial relationship, and then that scene is sort of the destruction of it. Does that make any sense? Or... Basically, I think it's the most important thing that happens to him in the second half of the film is when we find out what's happened to her.
Yeah.
Because without that, I think if she stuck around and was not married, didn't have children, he might be, I don't want to say okay, but I think he would start to go back to the pre-war era, which we see briefly. You see him briefly in that, and he seems more stable than, right. You know.
He's a guy who needs a push to go nuts, and he got it. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that could possibly bring him back is gone.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, that was the way that they structured that reveal of their relationship was weird to me, because he continuously talks about the letter that he got from her that said, like, what do they call it? Like a crying episode.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets a letter, which I guess we can assume is a Dear John letter. You know, I can't wait for you anymore. And he's talking about that. And then when they do the processing that leads to the flashback that we get that shows their relationship, he comes up to her and says, like, I got your letter. And so for a minute, I was like completely unsure of what was happening. I wasn't sure if he was picturing himself going back after the war to see her, like if this was some sort of, you know, let's play your life in a different way, if like you hadn't just not responded to her letter in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took me a minute to mentally adjust for the fact that like this was before that and this was the beginning of their relationship.
Yeah, that's the only narrative element which left me a little confused, but after that I bounced back when I realized.
And I think you're supposed to be confused.
Yeah, and I think there's a little bit of confusion when it comes to when he learns that she's now married and stuff. And stuff. I can't believe I just said that. But
she's all like married and junk.
Yeah. I think some people were assuming that that was before the cause for some reason. But that wouldn't work at all.
It wouldn't work. And I had that initial thought too, like this is something that happened before he went crazy. But no, he had run away from the cause and... Yeah, I don't know. There's so much unpacking to do in this movie. Like, I could talk just about the first scene where I don't know what the hell the genesis of their relationship is. Like, she wrote him a letter that said that she liked him, I guess. I don't know who they were to each other before that. But he shows up, and when she said she was 16, I was like, there's no freaking way. That girl looks like she's 7 feet tall compared to him. And he is like... he's sitting on that bench and the bench looks like it's swallowing him whole. Like, was I, because I was blown away by that at first. Like, it was like some Michel Gondry playing with perspective stuff in my head. Like, everything was towering over him.
Maybe it's because he looks kind of dopey in his sailor outfit.
Yeah,
he looks like a little kid.
That was what I kept thinking. I was like, he looks small and tiny, and I was trying to, I mean, it's one of those things you could read into it, like this is him thinking back then. You know, he's not the aggressive macho wannabe that he is now. And this girl is just towering over him and overpowering him because she's someone who he cares about and has power over him. It's nuts. This movie is incredible. And I think I need to go watch it again.
No other love.
Did anyone think when that... on my first viewing, when No Other Love started playing and he was driving off in the desert, half of me thought it was going to cut to black.
Oh, yeah, so did I.
Yeah, part of me was wondering that, too.
Not, like, that I wanted it or anything, but it just, like, something in me was like, oh, my God, is this going to end? Like, I want more.
I know. I was so pissed. I was like, I swear to God, if it ends right now, I'll kill someone. Okay, what? All right, I swear to God, this is the last thing we'll talk about. What the hell was up with Philip Seymour Hoffman singing Slow Boat to China?
I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, like, all to myself.
Yeah, just like that's like that. What? I was sitting there and I think my mouth literally dropped open during that scene because it just kept going.
Yeah, the theater was dead quiet during that scene because I think nobody knew how to react because it was so. And it's also that what makes it particularly uncomfortable is that it's a close up of his head,
yeah,
as he's singing it, and mm-hmm. You know he's got a big head, and when you're seeing 70 millimeter on this massive screen, it's really it's so imposing.
So, yeah, like you know. I don't know what he means by that. Like it's I don't know, ridiculous. This movie's in my head, man, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. Need to go see it again. I guess that's the best that we can say. We've done a job of a kind trying to dissect the thesis behind it, and draw some meaning out of it. But yeah, everyone listening at home, I'm hoping that you've seen it already if you've listened to the spoilers. Definitely let us know what you think at podcast@thefilmstage.com. I think now is as good a time as any to go and look forward to the week ahead. And we'll try to get through this a little quick because I know we're running long. And we'll see what's out in store for us.
Did you, should I talk about Trouble with the Curve really quick? I just remembered that.
Oh, shit, yeah. Yeah, what did you think of Trouble with the Curve?
Okay, this is just awkward now. So, Trouble with the Curve, I didn't have high expectations just because, but that doesn't say I had negative expectations, just the sense I got from the trailer that it was going to be a very conventional, kind of straightforward thing. And that was fine, so I was prepared for that. What I wasn't prepared for was just how uncomfortable a lot of the movie was in terms of Clint Eastwood's character is kind of like a PG-13 version of his Gran Torino character. And that just makes for some really weird scenes. The movie starts off where he's like trying to take a piss in the morning and he's like talking to himself and is a little bit awkward. And then a few scenes later, he's visiting the grave of his wife who passed away, and he sings her a song, and then that exact song starts playing on the soundtrack right as the scene is about to end. So the mix of sentimentality and like gruff old guy stuff worked a lot worse here than it did in Gran Torino for me. And so that kind of made the father-daughter stuff, as pleasant as Amy Adams is, it made that stuff really awkward for me. But the surprise of the movie is kind of Justin Timberlake in terms of his scenes with Amy Adams are kind of the best in the film. And I thought his role was going to be the one that was kind of forced in, but it's actually Eastwood's in a way that feels really awkward. So I wouldn't really recommend the movie. And hopefully if Eastwood acts again, it'll be with something better.
Yeah, I had absolutely no interest in seeing that film, and everything you've told me has done nothing in its favor. So, all right.
I still kind of want to see it, but I feel like I'll have to wait for the release because it's too crowded at the movies right now, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I still need to see The Master 6 more times. So,
yeah.
Just watch out for those curveballs.
They're troublesome.
They'll have some trouble with the curve. Does anybody in the movie say, "I've got trouble with the curve"?
I don't want to spoil that surprise for you.
Ah, damn. I love...
Someone actually says, "I have trouble with the curve," don't they?
Or he's got trouble with the curve.
Like, it's a very obvious point of the movie. Like, if you read A.O. Scott's review, he kind of just comes out and says, like, the actual title of this movie is kind of a spoiler, so that's strange. I don't know.
Does someone die on, like, a car crash going around a curve?
Oh, no.
Okay, because that was all I could think about. Before I knew what the movie was actually about, I was like, Trouble with the Curve. Dead Man's Curve. Right? So now I just have this image of someone, like, crashing a car or a motorcycle while going around a curve too fast. Maybe that's how the wife died.
There is some driving in the movie, but it's pleasant driving.
Ah, well, that's lame. Yeah, but now let's get into our look forward to the week ahead. Coming out on DVD, The Avengers. Hooray, I guess.
Oh. Because we haven't talked about that fucking movie enough.
That's something I can look forward to never buying.
It gets mentioned like every week on this show. And we got to stop with that.
This will be the last time we talk about it, I swear.
Now, let me just say it once. The Avengers. Okay.
Okay. Damsels in Distress. Soldiers of Fortune. The Samaritan. And then a bunch of TV shows. Also apparently The Tall Man, which has Jessica Biel in it.
That came out like 2 weeks ago.
Really? Because it's just showing here on the thing. I don't know. Whatever. I know it was on VOD. I don't know if it was on DVD. But yeah. Thoughts on these films? Any of them worth seeing? Honestly, you've all seen the A movie, so I don't, you know.
I want to see Damsels in Distress. The Bond 50 Blu-ray set is cool, but when the new one's coming out in like a month, isn't it kind of silly to release it?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like, you know, from what I understand, there's actually a slot for the Skyfall Blu-ray there, which is cool. But what do you do when the 24th or 23rd Bond movie comes out? You're kind of, or 24th Bond, I guess. I don't know.
This is the 23rd one.
Okay.
I've seen Damsels in Distress.
I know you didn't like it.
I didn't not like it. I thought it had its moments. It was kind of a quirky, weird film. I don't regret seeing it. I may see it again. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was okay.
Oh, you know what's coming out? Clown.
Oh, Clown.
Oh.
That's a good one.
We had a rigorous discussion of that film.
It's like The Master. You got to really dig through.
Every scene gets dissected. All right. Danny, did you have a thing coming out that you wanted to plug, or are you
with
the rest of us?
Yeah, I mean, I saw Damsels. I kind of had the same reaction as you. It was my first Whit Stillman movie, though, so I kind of want to watch his other films and then give it another go.
I'm a little bit the same way, I think.
Yeah, it was a little bit like getting to know a new friend. Like, yeah, you might be cool in a few months, but let's...
Right now, it's just a little awkward.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move into the theatrical releases. We have Looper, the new film by Rian Johnson, who did Brick and the Brothers Bloom. Hotel Transylvania, the... I didn't realize this was directed by Genndy Tartakovsky. He did Samurai Jack. I love that show.
He did?
Won't Back Down, I have no idea what that's about. Pitch Perfect, the, I don't know, step up of a cappella movies, I guess.
It's in limited release this weekend. Well, this coming weekend. Yeah, that's a sort of a platform thing they're doing for whatever reason.
I've actually heard good things about it, but I...
Yeah, so have I.
I refuse to believe them.
Yeah, that trailer is...
Fucking deadly.
Yeah, but I've also heard good things, so I'm just baffled.
Yeah, I don't understand. And the poster that is on IMDb is not doing it any favors.
Get pitch slapped.
Oh my god, it says that. I was not even looking at that. I was looking at the top with all the people, and like, fuck this movie. Get pitch slapped? Jesus. The Other Dream Team, a documentary coming out. The Waiting Room, also a documentary. And that's about it. I'm going to say Looper. Can't wait to see it. And we're actually going to be talking about it next week. So
yeah, you're making a wise choice.
Yeah. Hotel Transylvania doesn't look too bad. Right? Am I right?
Well, whatever.
Yeah,
whatever. It's fucking whatever. And, maybe I'll go and get pitch slapped. Because this the trailer and the poster are just, like, daring me to go see it. You know?
Really? You take that as a dare?
Yeah, like, I don't know.
I take that as their way of saying, you're probably not going to like this film.
But it's like that. Like, they're being so upfront about how much I won't like it that they, like, want me to go see it. Like, they want me to not like it. I don't know. I'm giving, like, malicious intent to a movie via its marketing. So we should probably move on to our random recommendations of things that we've seen. Unless anyone would like to disagree with me on seeing Looper. There's really not much else coming out.
No.
All right, excellent. So what have we seen this week that we think people should check out? Danny, why don't you start us off?
I watched a very disturbing film called The War Zone, directed by Tim Roth.
Oh, I was thinking about that movie yesterday.
I love that film.
Okay. We've all seen it.
I love that film.
Right, I can't believe we've all seen it, because like 10 people have seen that movie.
Yeah.
All right.
Or three.
It was on Netflix Instant.
Yeah, I watched it on Instant.
Yeah. Oh, such a good
one. One of my friends was over, and he's like, we're scrolling through, and he's like, yeah, that's in my top 10 of all time. Let's watch it. And I was like, all right, I won't say no to that. But it's really like a incredible directorial debut. It's kind of sad that he hasn't made anything since. I don't really want to give anything away about the plot, but it's about a family of four, and it's really interesting in that it pits Ray Winstone and Tilda Swinton opposite two completely unknown, untrained actors at the time the film was made. And the results are very devastating and sad and painful, but it's just something that gains your respect almost immediately. It's just a really powerful movie.
Yeah, that movie is utterly fantastic. And I'm like, I don't know why he hasn't made a new film.
Yeah, I saw that some 4.5 years ago, and I still remember the feeling after it ended, where I just kind of took my thumb and index finger and I just kind of put it on either side of my nose, you know? I just went,
I don't even remember when I saw that. I want to say, like, it must have just come out because I remember renting it on VHS from Blockbuster. And this is like when I was first really getting into films. The movie came out in 99. Yeah, that seems about right. I must have done it then, because I remember I also watched The Thin Red Line, which came out that year. VHS. Man, I am old as hell. But yeah, I remember watching that film and just being completely unprepared. Totally unprepared.
Yeah.
Like, good lord. Holy crap, was I 12? Why did my parents let me rent that movie? I just did the math in my head. I was like, holy shit.
So, am I the only one who saw this movie knowing what it's about? Or
I had an idea. I had heard good things. But I mean, like...
What do you mean by good things? Just that's a
powerful film. Like, basically what we're saying. You know, I read somewhere some review of it that was incredible. I also just rented it because, hey, Tim Roth directed a movie, and I loved him in Reservoir Dogs. That's like, you know, the stupid 12-year-old logic I was using at the time, apparently. Mm-hmm. This is actually the movie that's responsible for me falling in love with the writer Ian McEwan, because there was a preview on the VHS for The Cement Garden, a movie version of a book that he wrote, and so I went out and bought the book. You can imagine, if it's a preview on this, it's a pretty dark book. So yeah, I think we all agree The War Zone is a definite thing you should check out. And it's on Netflix Instant, so you don't have a reason not to.
Yeah, don't watch it when anybody's in your house.
Yeah. I started watching it, and one of the guys I live with came in and was like, yeah, I'll take a look at this. And I didn't tell him anything. And he became more and more crestfallen as the film went on. And it was over. He's like, that was great. I never want to fucking see that again.
What'd you just do to me, Brian?
Yeah.
Thought we were friends.
All right, Nick, what have you seen that you think we should check out?
I watched one new film since we recorded our podcast because school was fun. And that movie would be Werner Herzog's Nosferatu the Vampire from 1979. Have we all seen F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu?
I have not, but I am seeing it October 26th with live musical accompaniment.
Oh, very cool. I bet you'll enjoy that.
I know. AFI Silverman. Same place I saw The Master. Great theater. Check it out.
I can tell.
Unsolicited endorsement.
Have you seen it, Danny?
Yeah, I saw it last year in school. I haven't seen Herzog.
Herzog's movie is, I mean, to say it's different is a little, it's kind of, you know, derp. It's different because it's not silent and black and white. So right there. But no, it's quite an achievement. I think this is one of the best vampire movies I've ever seen. In particular, Klaus Kinski as Nosferatu is as horrifying as you would think. He is so fantastic in this role. And the way Herzog positions him in the scenes sort of give him this... We talked about how in The Master there's this moment where everything... It feels like everything is dwarfing Joaquin Phoenix. In this movie, Klaus Kinski dwarfs everything else. And his interpretation of it is so great. And Bruno Ganz is also in it. He plays Jonathan Harker. It's just a fascinating film to see how one of the most popular horror tales of all time, maybe the most popular horror tale of all time, is interpreted here. Highly recommended. Also, great use of Wagner, the same music that was used at the end of The New World, funny enough.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
I will definitely have to check that out. Personally, I watched a little film called Ravenous. Anyone here know about Ravenous?
No.
Seriously? No. Oh, this is so disappointing. Ravenous is, I'm trying to think of a good way to put it. It's a dark horror comedy type of film. It's Guy Pearce, Robert Carlyle, David Arquette is in there too.
I just looked up the poster. It's just a man's face screaming.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. The basic story is right after the, I guess, Mexican-American War, a war hero / coward is reassigned to a mountain outpost called Fort Spencer. It's like on the brink of manifest destiny, and the movie's about like cannibals like vampires. Like if you eat a person, you gain their strength. But then you also want to eat more people.
Oh, a little connection between our two films.
Yeah. and it's grounded in some kind of Native American mythology called the Wendigo. So there's that. But I mean, like, this movie is ridiculous. It's one of my go-to films. Like, I'll put it on any day. And I love introducing it to people because they have no idea what's going on. And, like, they're laughing because they're uncomfortable and they're not sure if they're supposed to be laughing. It's a great film. Everyone should check it out. Yeah, I'm really upset that none of you have seen it because I wanted to, I don't know. I was hoping we could crack some in-jokes about it, but apparently we can't.
I'm looking up the War Zone on IMDb, and I forgot that Colin Farrell was in that movie.
Is it his first role?
I think so, yeah. He plays, he's credited as, in the film, Colin J. Farrell.
Oh. A little pretentious when he went out first. actually, speaking of him, I also saw Fright Night, the new film.
What's going on with the vampires?
I don't know. But yeah, Fright Night's good, if no one's seen it. Very enjoyable film. I don't know. I just felt like throw that one out.
I haven't seen it, but
yeah, I don't know how well it did at the box office, but I saw it when it was in theaters, and I saw it yesterday, and it's a good film. You should all check it out. But yeah, that'll bring us to the end of our show today. We've gone a little long, but you know what? The Master deserved it. It demanded it, really. So yeah, let's tell the people where we can be found in the interim. Danny, why don't you start us off?
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And Nick?
TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And I can be found at DearFilm.net, my personal blog, also TheFilmStage.com, and also Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. So thank you again for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, and come back next week when we'll be discussing the time travel sci-fi action film Looper.
What Anderson is doing here is sort of a... Can you just cut this out, me not being able to collect my thoughts?
Oh, there's going to be so much editing on this podcast.
Okay, good.
Have you heard me stumbling? Jesus.
Okay.